Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Totally sucks.
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary, and with me is co-host Mike White.
You know, Romeo is bleeding, but not so as you'd notice.
No, there you go. This week, we're talking about Lloyd Kaufman's 1996 film, Tromeo and Juliet. The film is Troma's ode to the bard. Shakespeare goes shock as Kaufman updates the classic tale of star-crossed lovers from rival families to the mid-90s in New York City. Tromeo Q and Juliet Capulet meet, fall in love, and life is never the same for them or those around them. The House of Q and the House of Capulet were former business partners making movies, but something sour happened to turn sweet cinema into a bitter rivalry. Tromeo and Juliet is everything you need from an edgy mid-90s romance. Tattoos, piercing, kinky sexuality, interactive technology, and Lemmy, of course, as your humble narrator. But that's just scratching the surface. So, Mike, when did you first get a chance to see this?
Well, I'd say, what, about 2-3 months ago when you loaned it to me for the first time, so.
Well, hopefully it wasn't too bad of an experience.
Not too bad. I mean, I have to say, you know, of the three Troma films that you loaned to me, I'd say that Toxic Avenger was probably my favorite. This one was a little tough to get through, mostly at the beginning, but once it gets going, I found that I was able to enjoy it. But the opening, it seemed like any time that the guy with the little blonde pigtails was on screen, I was checking out anytime that he was there. So it was just like, when it was the romance, when it was Tromeo and Juliet and the stuff about the family, I could handle it. But when it was the extended family, the cousins and all that, it just got to be a little, I don't know, like that kind of typical Troma slapsticky kind of meets gore meets, you know, fart sound effects kind of stuff. And it was like, okay. But I really enjoyed Jane Jensen and Will Keenan in this. Whenever they were on screen, I could kind of let the other stuff go.
So you weren't a big fan of Sean Gunn, who's co-writer James Gunn's brother?
No. And, you know, I wonder when it comes to the writing of this, because it really felt like there were multiple writers on the film that didn't really kind of mesh at times. And there were times where they would break into the iambic pentameter and it's like, okay, you know, this is a little shticky and stuff, but it's kind of paying homage to Shakespeare. That's okay, cool. But then other times where it just felt like, I don't know, kind of more messy and everything. So it felt like it was a little schizophrenic at times.
Yeah, it's kind of true. I mean, when you look at the script, I know it went through several different hands. That's just the way that Lloyd works, and a lot of the stuff is even changed when they get to the set. So from my reading, I've come to understand there was actually an entirely written in Shakespearean verse version of this that was written a few years before the film was made. And actually, the Toxic Avenger was in it. And there was some other stuff that was connected into the Troma universe, but then they decided against that. And then when James Gunn, who was working at Troma at the time, and of course James Gunn now has gone on to do all kinds of well-known stuff in terms of he wrote the remake of Dawn of the Dead, he wrote the Scooby-Doo films, and then he has this video game that just came out that's getting a lot of press, this chainsaw lollipop thing, this girl in a skirt with a chainsaw. I saw a trailer for it. It's crazy. But he was working at Troma at the time, and then he started doing a draft on Tromeo and Juliet. And originally, Juliet was to be a stripper and Tromeo a crack dealer. So it's changed a little bit from there, obviously. And the one thing that I find that's interesting, and maybe we should talk about the plot a little bit and how it differs a bit from Shakespeare, is that I almost see it as kind of a little jab at the filmmakers themselves and at Troma.
Yeah, I can see that, especially with the partnership between Cappy Capulet and Monty Q. Definitely plays with some of the characters, and you know, the opening scene with the fight at the club, it does remind me a lot of the opening of Romeo and Juliet itself. But yeah, there are some good swipes in there, and it's funny that you say that, you know, Toxie was going to be in it, since he and Sergeant Kabuki Man kind of make some cameos in the club scene itself, just kind of you know, dancing there like they hang out in Tromaville, so that kind of makes sense.
As for the plot of Tromeo and Juliet, you know, it's standard Romeo and Juliet fare. You know, the couple meet, they're from rival families and fall in love. The ending's a little bit different, and that's probably the biggest change. As for the characters themselves that kind of go through the extended family, what it is that you find that they're, as you said, they're two filmmakers, and they each own this film company together, and then something sort of happens that drives a wedge between the two of them. And I find it interesting because I've met both Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Hirst, and I would have to say that the guy who plays Cappy does a really good job of having that sort of British Shakespearean acting, you know, thing. I think that's kind of fun for him, and to have him play sort of the Michael Hirst of the relationship versus Lloyd, who I guess is an overweight black man, is kind of interesting to me.
I just hope Michael treats his family a little bit better than Cappy Capulet does.
I'd say so. He seems like a rather nice man. He's very intense if you meet him, but he's a very nice man.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, because he doesn't necessarily treat Juliet as well as she should be treated. And one of the things that I like is the whole her having her nightmares and waking up and screaming, and him kind of punishing her for the screaming and everything. And the whole scene with the glass booth, I found that very effective as well. Like those kind of scenes I was really into, and I guess I was really into the family, the immediate family drama, as it were.
But that whole thing with the glass box and everything is also sort of a nod to this sort of aberrant sexuality that seems to run through the entire film, with him being the father and having this incestuous relationship with his daughter to some extent. Then you have the one thing that's interesting is this is obviously pre-internet, mainstream level of the internet. Obviously the internet was created in the late 60s, early 70s, but there's this whole thing with interactive CD-ROMs that is in there in several places, and then just computer technology as well, and sort of how these there seems to be like varying levels of things within this film, where the youth characters have certain touchstones for themselves. You know, like they're into the tattoos and the piercings and the computer stuff. And then it's like the old guard is more into, I guess, maybe the analog technology or something. And then when you get towards the end, some of those things are used against the older characters. So I think that's kind of interesting how they build these things in, as you know, the youth can use, I guess, their culture or their ideas or something against the corrupt old guard in some way.
Yeah, I totally see. That's a really good point. Going back to the CD-ROMs, I really like that Tromeo is so into finding true love, and that he gets so turned on by the CD-ROM that's like, I want to marry you. I want to marry you.
To make your choice of our many lovely girls, please press one of the following keys. If you like eating shit and drinking piss, there's only one choice there, it's K. But if you want a wild time with a very young girl, press... You chose true love. Please hold on for one moment.
Hello. You are so handsome. I really love you. Would you like to get married? Married? Then you could see my bosom. They love you too. go ahead. You could touch them.
Yeah, you know, forget just really hot sex. It's all about, you know.
Right. Finding the monogamous partner. Yeah.
And I think to some extent, you know, that does play into the themes of the original. I mean, obviously, Romeo and Juliet is a love story, but I think maybe it even plays into, although Lloyd has all this wackiness and craziness within his movies, he's very much a traditional man in that way. You know, he's a very traditional sort of family guy, and he's been married to the same lady for like, you know, 35 years. So, I mean, it probably just plays into his own psychology.
Yeah, and I like that Juliet was more of a sexualized character in this. Of course, she was very exploited by her father and everything, but just that she was into, you know, calling 900 numbers and all that.
Yes. Oh, yes. Say my name again.
Okay. I'm fucking fashion. I'm fucking fashion real good.
Yes.
Shit. That's right. We're having major sex.
Romeo.
And I enjoyed that about her, that she wasn't just this kind of chaste, you know, being. And I did like the play on the famous balcony scene where we've got now Juliet inside of this glass box and Romeo coming in and doing the whole, you know, what light through yonder window breaks kind of thing. But the whole the whole hand on the cheek thing, the way that they twist that, I did find that very amusing.
What light from yonder plexiglass breaks? It is a right-angled cosmos. And Juliet is its sun. See how she leans her cheek upon her hand? Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand. I might touch that cheek.
Yeah, there's all kinds of little touchstones back to the original that if they weren't in there, then you would be like, oh, they're missing an opportunity to have some fun with it. And in that one, they do. The other one I like, which is in the trailer as well as in the film, is the where after they meet and all that, and she's like, parting is such sweet sorrow. And his response is, yeah, totally sucks. So I think that kind of thing, and then, you know, rewriting it a little bit is really it's fun. I mean, that's what I really enjoy about it. But I think that, like I said, Lloyd's trying to also make larger points about sort of these generational divides, and I also sort of, we were talking about making a comment on that period. I mean, in the mid 90s, a lot of this stuff was still kind of underground. I mean, tattoos and piercings are all over the place. You have reality shows on it. Back then, that was sort of still, you know, kind of punk or metal, or I don't know, you know. I mean, you're a couple years older than me, so when did you sort of start seeing that? I mean, it was like you had to be, I remember when I was a kid, it was like the only people that had tattoos were like old guys who were in the Navy and bikers.
Right. Yeah. Gosh, growing up, I didn't have any friends that had any kind of tattoos. So it's really funny to see the difference. And I don't know, this is just kind of an aside, you know, seeing how it has progressed through pornography. I mean, we've got people who are in the porn industry are always usually on the quote unquote fringes of society. And just to see even back in the, I would say, mid to late 90s, how scandalous it was to have a porn actor or actress that had a tattoo, and just, you know, what a big deal that was. And now it's very difficult to find a porn actor or actress that doesn't have tattoos. I mean, they are everywhere. The last time I went to the Cine King Film Festival, it was like so rare to see a performer that had minimal to no ink. It was the rarity now instead of the exception. So yeah, seeing the scene of the nipple piercing at the tattoo shop back in 1996 was definitely very much on the fringe. I mean, I'm thinking even working in the nascent days of the internet, which was definitely populated by a lot of people that were kind of on the edge, as it were. Not very many of my coworkers even were these kind of tattooed people. I mean, but now, you know, the last job that I worked at, I mean, people had spacers in their ears. They had, you know, the nose piercings, everything. So it was really, it's definitely changed much more over the years. I'd have to say that 96, 97 was probably when that stuff was really starting to come into the whole modern primitive movement.
Whenever I think of piercing, it's to me like piercing and tattoos and all that stuff, it's really all just kind of jewelry now. It doesn't really have, as you were saying, sort of the impact that it originally had because nobody really had it. And I'm reminded of a joke that Carlin had before he passed away, where he was like, look, he's like, if you're a man and you have an earring, it's just jewelry. He goes, you're not really making a statement unless you have a piercing with a live baby hanging from it. It's just jewelry. So yeah, but that's the thing that, I mean, this is only, you know, 16 years on, and it's amazing just sort of how the culture has shifted, that a lot of this stuff, if you had a kid today watch it, they'd be like, oh, this is just normal. They wouldn't even understand that all of this is sort of underground and weird for that era.
Exactly. Yeah, now it's like, why don't these people have more tattoos? They work at a tattoo shop. Geez, they should be, you know, Kat Deely, who's just covered from head to toe, you know, eyebrows to navel to, you know, big toe kind of thing. I'm curious, you know, talking about the body and the body image and stuff, what was your take on kind of the whole body horror of Juliet and her recurring nightmares? I mean, do you think that was kind of incest related, or do you think there was more to it? Because it was almost always kind of coming from the womb, like she was pregnant, but with different things that were going on.
I think you could kind of take it two ways. You could say that it might be related to the incest stuff, but I think it also has to do with sort of coming into your own in sexuality. And sort of the, I don't know how to say it, I guess maybe the fear or the scariness of evolving into an adult. And there's a great graphic novel sort of on a similar vein called The Black Hole by Charles Burns that I read, where he has a group of teenagers and they all start getting these like diseases. They start getting these like weird things happening to them. But it's really an allegory for coming into your own sexually and how you can like never go back. Like, your childhood is gone as soon as, you know, sexuality happens. And that's sort of what I saw it as. I saw it as sort of some part of her reacting to the fact that she's becoming an adult, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, I have to say the scene with Will Keenan eating the popcorn out of her stomach was particularly a favorite, and especially his he's just so into that popcorn, man. He is just really digging that popcorn.
Yeah, that's a pretty good scene. As a matter of fact, later when you hear the interview with Jane, she'll talk about that whole scene because it gets weirder. It moves beyond the popcorn into mealworms and rats. That was a bit much for her to deal with.
Yeah, I can't really blame her on that.
The other thing that kind of runs through this film, and Lloyd does it more in the later films, especially in Terra Firma, where he takes Amazing Grace and runs it through the whole film, is Shall We Gather at the River, this Christian hymn that just repeats over and over and over again throughout the film in different versions. Kind of wanted your take on that. I mean, what do you think he's trying to do with that song?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure that this was kind of colored by my perception, but you know, I'm not real into the whole Christianity thing, and so I was kind of noticing it more when when Cappy Capulet was around and they were playing that, and it just kind of reminded me of like, you know, just kind of that Pentecostal kind of, you know, acceptance of incest and, you know, just those kind of things. So I wasn't really picking up exactly where it was coming in, and I noticed that it was there, but what I was noticing more was that kind of Romeo and Juliet love song theme song that was coming in, because I was humming that all the next day, you know, because that song just kind of got really stuck in my head because it's catchy as hell, man. And they play it at least three times nearly all the way through. So that was, you know, definitely there for me. But yeah, when it comes to Can We Gather at the River, I wasn't picking up exactly where Lloyd was going with that.
I'll tell you, I think that where it really comes from is maybe an homage to filmmakers that he liked, because I know that at least around the Troma offices, there was a lot of John Ford fans, and it's my understanding that Ford used to use that melody quite a bit in things. He used it in Stagecoach, and we'll be talking about Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia soon, and Sam Peckinpah actually used it in Major Dundee and also in The Wild Bunch, so I think maybe it has some sort of tie back to filmmakers that he liked. I don't necessarily believe that it might have the resonant impact that the use of Amazing Grace has in Terra Firma, because in that he's a blind guy, so there's all this reference obviously to Once Was Blind and Now I See. So, but Shall We Gather at the River, I don't really know.
Yeah, there aren't too many rivers in this one.
No. Well, there's the Hudson, I guess.
Right.
And the East River. But one of the ideas that I really like in Romeo and Juliet is there's this one scene towards the end that I like when the characters who have all died because of them come back and get their revenge. And I, when I saw that scene the first time I saw Romeo and Juliet years ago, I go, yeah, right on.
Oh, true apothecary, thy drugs are quick. Oh!
You didn't think a potion could do what he claimed. Now, did you, Juliet? After all, it was an FDA approved.
You are correct, Prozac boy. And in just a few minutes, you'll be joining us. Of course, you won't be as pretty as me.
It's only fair, don't you think, Juliet? Because of you, we are dead. You find the greatest love the world has ever known. And on the way, we have to pay for it with our lives!
No!
As if Miss Juliet Capulet is so all-important, and we're just little tiny ants to be squashed!
Oh, Sammy, baby, you got that right! Squashed!
Squashed!
Decimated! That's the one thing I guess I kind of thought in high school when we had to read this, the original Shakespeare, was, man, there's a lot of death in this, and people are dying, you know, and getting killed or whatever, just so, you know, two horny teenagers can get together.
Yeah, and they are, in the original, they are teenagers, and we tend to forget that this is kind of that, you know, that higher drama of first love kind of thing, and it's not one of these, you know, they're not 19, 20, 21 years old, they're, you know, 14, 15 years old in the original, so it's it tends to be heightened because of that as well, and then, you know, leading to the tragic end, as it were.
What else did you pick out in the film that you really liked that kind of resonated with you? You said you did like the romance and sort of the back and forth with the family, but not so much the extended family.
Yeah, just the, you know, that kind of gross out trauma humor doesn't really do it for me sometimes, you know, limbs being severed, and, you know, I didn't mind the severed head landing in the James Gunn's cameo appearance in his car when he and his family are singing Hannah Peanut, and especially the reaction afterwards when they're talking about just, you know, how can you do this to this family that we're singing Hannah Peanut and all that. So there are some lines here and there that I enjoyed, and like I said, I dug the romance, and I dug the actual, you know, interchange, and I especially liked, well, gosh, the one scene that I really, really liked, it was such a throwaway, but it was still great, was the priest talking about his love that he had, and he knows what it is to know true love that can never be requited. So that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and Lloyd was on the edge with this. I mean, this is obviously 10 years plus before the priest abuse scandal.
Yeah, but it totally worked. It was so good. And yeah, like I said, it was just a little throwaway, but it really worked for me. And I enjoyed that character as well. But yeah, that was like, as I said, once I got past that first act, I was able to kind of dig this movie a little bit more.
The one thing that I also liked in here, too, and I brought it up a little bit, is the guy who plays Cappy Capulet, Juliet's dad, has this real gravitas as an actor, you know, real Shakespearean actor kind of thing. And from time to time, they'll be out doing something. There'll be some event, and then he'll pause, and he'll do, like, a couple of lines of dialogue, and then right. he'll tell you, that was this play, this scene.
Yeah. Richard IV, yeah. scene two, act one. Yeah. yeah.
It's stupid, but it's funny at the same time, just to have a character pull themselves out and do lines from another play.
And I liked Monty Q whenever he was on screen. He wasn't on screen a whole lot, but whenever he was, I enjoyed that, because he seemed to be just kind of overacting, but in a different way, kind of a little bit more sincere in the way that he was overacting. Like, he was really trying hard, and it was just, you know, not necessarily coming across as sincere or as good as it could have been. But he was into his whole thing, as opposed to just that kind of, you know, gnashing of teeth and rolling of eyes, that other kind of overacting.
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the narrator.
Oh, God, yeah. And speaking of a time when you really want subtitles to be on a Troma DVD, this is definitely that time.
But he's speaking English, so you shouldn't need subtitles.
Well, maybe he's speaking Middle English, because I'm just having a little bit of a hard time understanding him.
Oh, come on. It's Lemmy. Lemmy is God.
Well, much like some people misinterpret the word of God, I was having a hard time understanding what Lemmy was saying.
Two households, differences, dried plums and pears, in fair Manhattan, where we lay our scene. Two homes adrift in hate for 20 years, a score, awash in sin for long deprived of dreams. Once long ago, they planted seeds of hate, which bloomed to constant battles for revenge. Soon murder was the awful commonplace, and everything once real seemed like pretend.
It's fun to see him, and then he pops up later in other Troma films, but doesn't get as big of a role in the other ones. He just sort of has cameos, but in this, he's sort of the he's the narrator. He sets everything up for us and walks us through the acts. And, you know, it's funny, as I was listening to the commentary with James Gunn and Lloyd, and I guess Lemmy came in and wanted to rewrite all of the narration, and I guess Gunn just hated Lemmy. Just, they didn't get along, and he was saying that he showed up like completely drunk, which, come on, I mean, this is what you expect. And, you know, for a rock star guy. And
yeah,
they put
rock and roll.
He put all, he's like, oh, yeah, we'll put all your new dialogue on the cue cards, you know? So Gunn just wrote his dialogue on the cue cards and made him read what he originally wrote. And he said he didn't have a problem with him then, because he didn't even know that he wasn't saying what he wanted to rewrite. So.
Yeah, nice. You know, the thing that I was questioning, though, and I know that this is such a minor thing, but it still was getting me, was that, you know, the scene of our play was in Manhattan, according to what Lemmy's saying, but shouldn't it actually be Tromaville?
Well, then you'd have to do it over in New Jersey. You'd have to shoot it all in Newark or something.
Right. It is nice to see Lemmy downtown New York City. And just kind of, you know, I wonder if traffic was stopping that day for Lemmy.
And that's, in the thing that's nice about Times Square behind him in that opening, is that's the sleazy Times Square. That's the pre-Disneyfied Times Square of today. So you can, you know, and it wasn't that long ago. It was only like 15, 16 years ago. So it's kind of interesting to see that in the background.
Had it been a little bit later, later in the day, they might have been seeing Frankenhooker walk through there.
There you go.
Want a date?
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back with an interview with director Lloyd Kaufman and Tromeo and Juliet themselves, Will Keenan and Jane Jensen.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
And I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, God. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Hi, Dave Nelson, host of the Comedy Go-Go podcast, whose previous guests include...
Hey, this is Carlos Alzaraki, James Garcia from Reno 911.
Hey, this is Graham Ellis.
Hey, this is Kyle Kinane.
Hi, this is Jackie Cation.
This is TJ Miller.
Hey, this is Nick Vatterott.
So if you fancy yourself a comedy fan, maybe even a comedy nerd, check out the podcast at www.comedya-go-go.com or on iTunes under Comedy A Go Go. And remember...
Yeah, it's a go-go, all right? It's not a went-went, all right? It is current-current, all right? Listen to me on the podcast. I feel like this went awry.
I just wanted to do Shakespeare, and Romeo and Juliet had a pun in it. if I had come up with some dumb pun about the Tempest, and I could have made that title into something to do with trauma, but this one hit me. It was basically Romeo, and then I said, well, of course, why not? Romeo and Juliet is the greatest romantic movie, certainly the greatest romantic tragedy in history. So there it is, Romeo and Juliet, and I had gotten interested in the fact that kids were tattooing themselves and piercing themselves, and my take on it was that the '60s, this post-war generation, and you see it in the entertainment industry. You see who the hell goes to see Rod Stewart in concert? Of course, he's a crooner now, but I mean, who goes to this crap? But yet. They're still around, and the younger people are being smothered by this Clinton generation, this oh-so-cool 60s, yuppie, never going to let go, close the gate behind you and tax the shit out of everybody else, that whole thing. And that's sort of where Romeo and Juliet came from, that perhaps young people are, since they're so disgusted by the 50% divorce rate and that the real sense of love seems to be disappearing and true emotion is gone. And so they decide, well, I'll turn inward and concern with myself. And so they tattoo themselves and pierce themselves and indulge in autoerotic asphyxiation, that sort of stuff. And because they're inward looking. And so that's where Romeo and Juliet sort of comes in. And luckily, and that was about a 5-year pull. Luckily, James Gunn came along and he really made it happen. He wrote it. But we had been trying to write stuff for 5 years and we couldn't figure it out. And James did it.
Yeah. What was it like to work with him in those days?
He was the best. He was great. He was the one who, whenever you make a trauma movie, there are usually a small number of people who really get it and are really believing it and are just doing everything they can to make the film worthwhile, to make it look good. Be good, and he made sure that Romeo and Juliet was good. You know, he we had he and Andrew Weiner and one or two other people were a team that was really, really, really tight.
The casting, I mean, you had Jane Jensen and Will Keenan, obviously, as your two leads, and Sean Gunn, James Gunn's brother. I mean, how did you come across these folks? I mean, did they just come in for auditions?
James Gunn knew a lot of talented people. He knew, his brother was great, and Valentine Mealy, who played Murray, it was brilliant. These guys are terrific. And James had, there were other people that James knew. Jane Jensen came in just on open call, and she was like the first actress, literally the first one, I think, who we interviewed, or the first one we called back, maybe. But it was the first day she was there. She might have been the first one, but and I liked her from the beginning. But James and Andrew Weiner had picked out somebody else who they preferred, but the other person kind of disqualified herself.
The other one that I have to ask you about is Lemmy. How did you get Lemmy?
Apparently, he's a fan, and he knew David Schultz, or David Schultz somehow, Lemmy's manager and one of our employees, I believe David Schultz, were buddies, and then it turned out that Lemmy was interested in Troma, and it happened that Lemmy was in New York whilst we were filming Tromeo and Juliet, so and was nice enough to offer, you know, to agree to be in our film, and so we made him the narrator, which was a very stupid Lemmy's very hard to understand when he talks, but he has the most amount of dialogue, I think, in the whole movie. He really cannot understand him, but he's a good guy. And he's in a bunch of Troma movies. And he most recently gave us a song for Mr. Bricks, a heavy metal murder musical. So Lemmy's still being really nice to us.
Tromeo and Juliet also starts, I think, the beginning of you talking about meat and vegetarianism. And then this goes into several films later. I think Terra Firma, it's in there. It's definitely in Poultrygeist. How come, like, sort of meat and vegetarianism has kind of got stuck in your craw, and it's now become something that keeps popping up in your films?
Well, my daughter, Charlotte, who you may remember played Audrey in Terra Firma, the mute child of the film director, she was vegetarian, and then PETA became a sponsor of Troma Dance Film Festival for a couple of years, and then I started watching some of the PETA and sort of listening to PETA, and between my daughter and PETA, I was like, oh, I can't do this anymore. I got to stop eating flesh. I mean, I do eat human flesh, but that's it. I don't eat any other flesh. No, other than human. So I think my daughter and PETA, and I recently directed, I recently directed a, and Troma made a PSA for PETA, and it's on their site.
If I profane with my unworthiest hand the holy shrine, the gentle sin is this: my lips, two blushing pilgrims, ready stand to smooth that rough touch with the tender kiss.
Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much. While mannerly devotion shows in this, for saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch.
You were cast as Tromeo and Tromeo and Juliet. Can you kind of explain how that whole tale came to be?
Yeah, this was a few weeks before NYU graduation, and me and a bunch of my buddies from NYU who went to the, you know, Tisch School of the Arts, the drama department, were kind of sitting around my kitchen. I think we were playing cards or something, and deciding like what the hell we were going to do after graduating. And a friend of mine, Sun King Davis, had said, you know, he had one of those newspapers, the Backstage newspaper, which has a lot of the auditions. And he said, oh, my God, Troma's casting their new movie. And I was like, who's Troma? And all my friends looked at me like I was, crazy. And then they told me that, you know, about this essentially, you know, cult movie company. And I had never seen any of their movies. But I looked at the casting notice and I decided to go down and check it out. And, you know, it was right in there, right there in Hell's Kitchen. And James Gunn was there. Andrew Weiner was there for the casting. And I think they had pretty much found Jane Jensen already. They kept her there all day. And for guys they thought, you know, might work, they would have them run through the scenes with her. So I kind of got a call back in the room and worked with Jane Jensen and really kind of, you know, hit it off with James Gunn and Andrew Weiner. And then it was the waiting game. And I think it took a couple of days. But I'm told that the tape was shown to Lloyd and that he asked his wife, Pat Kaufman, you know, what she thought about me. And I'm told that she was actually the final say. And she was the one who said, yes, hire Will Keenan. And then history was made.
So you didn't have much exposure to trauma. How did they explain it to you? Did they like pull out the Toxic Avenger or something? Or what was your first real exposure?
I had seen the posters and by this point I had visited the office and maybe had seen some clips. But I think the day I started shooting, I still hadn't even seen a full trauma movie. And I got to be honest. I mean, now I obviously I've seen a bunch and I can appreciate, you know, what they are. And I know why they have an audience. And I've, you know, after Tromeo, embraced it to the extent that, you know, for the next one, Terra Firma, I signed back up. But my real interest in making Tromeo and Juliet was that there was actual Shakespeare in it. And, you know, if you're an actor who goes to, you know, a professional acting school where there's some Shakespeare training, most of the guys and girls I know who started studying Shakespeare, at least from the performance aspect, fall in love with it because it's like a full-bodied kind of, you know, acting technique. So I really just wanted to be able to do Shakespeare on film because I figured, you know, this may not happen again. There aren't many films made that have actual Shakespeare, you know, iambic pentameter in them. So I kind of went for it. And then as I read the script and realized what the hell I was getting into, you know, the part of NYU that I went to, at least the last 2 years, was called the Experimental Theater Wing. So I was already a pretty weird guy. And I'll just say that the transition from experimental theater to cult film was somewhat of a smooth one.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, obviously you had done some Shakespeare before at NYU, and then to go to this sort of, I don't know, like tortured pig Latin version of Shakespeare to some extent. Right. What was that shock like for you?
It wasn't really. I mean, we used to, like, once you get into Shakespeare, you get into it. Like, you know, and I think I had just finished a whole semester of Shakespeare acting. And, you know, if you get into Shakespeare that much, especially on a performance level, you end up, like, you know, saying it, you know, with your buddies as you're walking down the street, you know, and you start creating your own, you know, lines, iambic pentameter. And, you know, so I think that part was the smoothest for me because it was my first film as well, right? So it was the other stuff. It was trying to get used to all the blood, guts, and gore and all the, you know, the crazy trauma-style comedy, you know. But I think after the first week, I pretty much, you know, embraced it and got, you know, weird.
So how was it working with Lloyd Kaufman as a director?
If you're a lead actor, like I was with him on two movies, it's pretty great. And he admittedly says that, you know, with supporting roles and with, you know, character roles, you know, you can fire him, you can get rid, or they can, in many instances with trauma, because the conditions are so tough, people will quit. Actors will just walk off the set. But Lloyd, if you're a supporting actor or a smaller role, he can easily replace you and, you know, make a joke about it. But it's virtually impossible to replace the leads. You have to kind of reshoot. So he's nice to his leads. So I was treated like a king for both films. On Terra Firma, where I was also, you know, I had a hand in producing and casting and staging a lot of the action, I worked with Lloyd much more closely and, you know, really, really enjoyed it. I mean, I consider him a mentor. I learned a whole lot from Lloyd, you know, about low budget filmmaking, about grassroots publicity, you know, the art of the soundbite. You know, I really kind of when I was working with him, I was like a sponge because he's a master at what he does. And, you know, I think a lot of what I've been able to do in my career, you know, had to do with kind of being, you know, it was essentially my film school, you know, Trauma. I went to NYU because it was so expensive. I, you know, pretty much double majored and double minored, you know, philosophy, dance, and theater and psychology to get my money's worth. But as far as learning how to make film, at least indie films, you know, my school was Lloyd Kaufman. But he's the first person to tell you. I mean, have you seen that documentary about him making Terra Firma? He's, you know, he walks on set, and I think he makes a decision to make someone cry when he walks on set, because it sends kind of like the, you know, it sends a vibe out through the set that, you know, don't mess up or you're going to get fired, you know. But working with him is not easy, you know. He said he and his old buddy Oliver Stone kind of, they use the chaos theory when they work on film, which is you create, you know, environment of chaos, and they think it keeps everyone on their toes, you know. So that's one way of working.
The cast in Tromeo was pretty great. I mean, you talked a little bit about when you were first doing those reads with Jane Jensen, sort of mm-hmm. how is she to work with in doing the work on Tromeo?
She was awesome. I mean, I've always, you know, only two trauma movies, but, you know, kind of knowing what goes into productions like that, I've always, you know, had immense respect for the girls, especially. And Jane was great. But I think, you know, like me, because we were the lead actors, I think, you know, we were shielded, at least on that first movie, we were shielded a lot from, you know, the madness that often accompanies working on a trauma film.
How was it working with the Gunn brothers?
Awesome. I mean, they're extremely, extremely nice, creative, really, really fun guys, and, you know, genius level talents. So it was Sean and James on that project. And, you know, James was probably, you know, the hardest working person on set. And Sean, you know, besides being a supremely talented, you know, performer, you know, they're such cool guys that, you know, I mean, working on trauma films is not easy, right? It's very little money. You know, it's not like, you know, kind of 5-star craft services. The hours are long. And then trying to pull off these scenes with all these kind of intricate, you know, prosthetics and blood and guts and gore and comedic timing, it's not easy. But guys like James Gunn and his brother and Andrew Weiner and a few of the others on the, you know, at least Tromeo, really kind of, you know, created an environment where we were all in it together. And, you know, there's so many things that can go wrong on an independent film set that do go wrong on an independent film set. But if you can keep, you know, a positive outlook, or if you can keep, you know, having fun, then you can get through it, you know. So those guys definitely got us through it.
It was actually James Gunn who wrote the script, I guess, with Lloyd and a few other folks. I mean, when you had time to sit down and talk to him about what he was trying to do with it, taking obviously a story that everyone knows from Shakespeare and twisting it a little bit, what was sort of the conversations you were having with him, obviously as someone who had just came out of school, who had studied Shakespeare?
Yeah. You know, I don't remember too much, but I bet if you ask James, I bet he would say I had lots of questions, or I may have been the, you know, the Shakespeare purist on set. So I bet you I caused some trouble, at least on the kind of, what's that term in theater? When someone who's supposed to be, come on guys, what's that person in theater? The one who's supposed to stick to the script and,
oh, like the script
dramaturg.
Role or the
dramaturg?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. I probably tried to play the dramaturg role on that set. I mean, I don't remember having any battles with anybody, but like I said, I bet you if you asked James, I was the one who thought I knew Shakespeare the most or something, even after James was going, I think, to Columbia at the time. So, you know, not only a very, very smart guy, but was like getting his, you know, his degree in literature. So, you know, and to be able to to take something like Shakespeare, and not only to, you know, there's, you know, even filmmakers today, I think the last one was the Ralph Fiennes movie, you know, to modernize Shakespeare is not easy, you know, to act Shakespeare is not easy, you know, to even, you know, to do a Shakespeare theater production is not easy, but to do a film like that and then make it punk rock, you know, that's why I think it's, you know, it's been called a cult classic. You know, it's not easy to do. People still try it all the time. I mean, people send me, you know, clips or trailers of their new movies, and, you know, everyone tries to kind of strike that tone of taking something, you know, that's in the collective unconscious now of the world, something like Shakespeare, and then putting a kind of low budget genre or cult film or horror spin on it. You know, but it's not easy.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of bad Shakespeare adaptations.
Yeah, right.
So what do you think you learned from making Tromeo that kind of has helped you since then? I mean, this is your first one right out of the gate. So what kind of lessons did you learn on this? And then, you know, not only just as an actor, but also as a producer and director.
Well, it being my first film, there's still something that, you know, I realized in that first film that I'm still working on. And that is that, you know, I was trained as a theater actor, you know, and I was used to kind of projecting to the back seats, you know. And on film, you have this camera, which is this one eye, which pretty much catches everything. So I remember the first time seeing Tromeo at Cannes in like 1996 or something, and watching it on screen for the first time and just being horrified at how big I was. I was too big for the camera. And I couldn't look at myself. To me, I looked like a trauma monster. But that's when that first started to happen, where I realized, okay, the differences between film acting and theater acting. I had heard about them, but I think because it was my first film, I was just worried about trying to get the emotion right and it feel real to me. And I was just so used to feeling real in a really broad way, you know, in a theater, so that people could see me from the back. So I think I've gotten better at that. I learned a whole lot about making low budget movies, just being on set and kind of, you know, watching Lloyd work, watching James, obviously, and the crew. It was after that movie. I did one other one right after the Good Machine film, Love God, the first fully digital feature film. And it was after those two, my first two movies, that I then wrote, produced, and directed a little short film called Hoof Boy. So I had learned enough on those two movies where I thought, okay, I can try this, you know. Like I said, Troma was my film school, and then after I had acted in two of them, I started making my own movies. And then as an actor on Tromeo, because in theater, I used to kind of stay in character for a few hours before a performance, really to get into it. And I've heard about actors, whether it's, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, I think I'm told Anthony Hopkins, and, you know, a host of others who stay in character all day long, even in their trailers or when they're going to get craft services on a film set. But I felt for my, you know, especially for the kind of characters I was playing, that, you know, and I learned on Tromeo that it can be really exhausting to kind of stay in character. So, you know, I learned that after Tromeo, and then, you know, for the subsequent films after that, how to kind of balance out your time on set, because there is a lot of hurrying up and waiting. Sometimes, you know, you're waiting around hours and hours for a shot. So if you're in character doing that, it's either going to exhaust you, or, you know, some people actually use that time to stay in character, and then they find more to work with inside them for their character. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a balance for me.
Are there any good stories from Tromeo that you can tell now that the statute of limitations have expired?
There's a few stories I've always wanted to tell, but can't. I think we have to wait another 50 years. And to be completely honest, it was so long ago, I don't remember much from it. I wish I had kind of kept a diary or something. And that's with a lot of the early films I had made. You know, I'll get together or have, you know, kind of semi reunions with people, and they'll remind me, you know, of certain stories or stuff that happened. And I'm like, wow. It's like, you know, hearing it for the first time. So I don't I don't really remember much. I think I was just I was nervous. It was my first film, and I was so in my own head. You know, I do remember that every once in a while they had to come look for me because I would go off, you know, to be by myself while I was waiting around for a shot. So, I can't. You know, and just watching Lloyd work and the kind of the energy he creates on set. If you're a fly on the wall or if you're a camera catching the behind the scenes, you know, Lloyd can come off as a madman. But, you know, like Lloyd says, you know, making movies is like going to war, you know, and everyone working, you know, to make the movie is his, you know, are his troops, you know. So it was quite eye opening.
Are you angry? Are you angry that I'm a Q? Do you hate me for my name?
What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. So Tromeo would, were he not Tromeo called to attain the dear perfection that he owns without the title.
I've been doing a lot of indie film and some smaller budget films in the Midwest, and started out doing some theater and commercials when I was, you know, in high school. And then when I got to New York, I did a film called Jane Street. I think there are actually two films called Jane Street. There's one that's kind of got an indie vibe to it, and then there's one that's, I think it's a gay porn film, and I'm not in that one. But it's a film by the same name. But Tromeo and Juliet, it definitely got the most attention, and I got a lot of notoriety for that film. It was the first time I started going to film festivals with Troma and doing film conventions, so it was definitely a different kind of experience for me and really an exciting experience.
How did you get hooked up with those guys with Troma?
I was a fan of the Toxic Avenger. You know, Troma is really visible in New York City, so I was aware of the company. And my brother-in-law at that time was a gaffer and had told me a lot about Troma and the Troma company in general. And I saw in the paper that they were holding auditions, and they were auditioning for Juliet. And I think I had a mohawk. Yeah, I definitely had like a grown-out mohawk at that time. And I figured, what the heck? I flattened my mohawk down, and I went over to the Troma offices, and I auditioned.
And what was that process like, going through the auditions and then eventually getting cast?
It was a lot of fun. I remember, meeting James Gunn and Andrew Weiner on the first day, and they wanted a monologue, and so I wrote a monologue for the audition called Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Tromaville, and I referenced a lot of the different Troma films in my monologue, and I think that really pleased them. They didn't decide on me for Juliet the first time they met me. They definitely had me come back. I think they met every girl in New York before. They were just like, oh, all right, we'll go with Jane.
What was the process like once you were cast in terms of trying to create this character? I mean, it's kind of Shakespeare, it's kind of not. It's kind of Shakespeare on acid. I mean, how do you kind of come up with this?
It was, the first time I read the script, it was really funny. And I thought the only way to play it was just to be really serious about it. And I just, you know, I felt Juliet was pretty depressed because her family is really fucked up and she's got a lot of issues, but she's absolutely falling in love. So I just tried to take a really serious approach with it.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, the challenges, you know, when I talk to folks, we talked to Will as well about working with Lloyd, and he's worked with him a few times. And, you know, what do you see as sort of the challenges when you were on the film and working with Lloyd and the Troma folks?
I think having a good time with it. You know, for me, the hardest part was some of the makeup. I think the day that I did the monster, the cow monster, that I remember that was a really hard day for me because I sat in makeup for a really long time, and Will thought I was really ugly that day, so he didn't want to have lunch with me. But I think the fact that the monster costume had a penis made him really nervous. So I didn't hold it against him, but you know, it was wacky. So I just tried to have fun with it.
There any good stories of on the set, things that you remember from doing the shoot?
I remember there was a song that Lloyd really wanted me to sing. It was a song he said it meant a lot from his childhood. He couldn't believe I didn't know it. It was called Gather at the River by this guy, Robert Lowry. It was a gospel hymn, and I told him I didn't know it, and he said, well, you got to hear it in the right context. So we were doing rehearsals, and it was in the evening, and the sun was down. He had a PA go up, and they made like a little campfire on the roof, and we roasted marshmallows, and Lloyd got his guitar out, and he started singing this Gather at the River song. And it was just really sweet, and James Gunn got all teary, and I was like, James, are you okay? And he's just like, oh, it's just the smoke, you know, or maybe it's like the gravity of what we're doing. I don't know, but it was really a sweet moment, and Lloyd showed me the chords, and Juliet actually plays that song in the film, and yeah, we had a lot of fun.
You mentioned Will, and I brought him up as well. How is he to work with as your Tromeo to your Juliet?
He was great. Will and I were really good friends during that film, and he was a really good actor. He was very focused, and he was always surrounded by girls, so it was very easy for Juliet to feel jealous and left out. He was a consummate flirt.
You talked a little bit about it, but once the film was finished, sort of what did you think of it, and then what did you think of the response?
Well, it was a really busy, busy time. And right away when the film was done with the editing, we were going to film festivals, and I was amazed. I was going to France and Spain and Park City to promote the film. And the first few times that I saw it was really during these festivals. So I would see a bit of it, and I would go out to the lobby and do, you know, interviews. And so anyway, it was an extremely exciting time. And after that, it wasn't long after that that I was signed to Flip and Interscope and was doing a lot with recording and touring. And it's funny, it's sort of like the film that just keeps getting reborn, you know? So it's definitely got a life of its own.
A few of the folks who you mentioned already, you went on to work with on other things. Will, you were in at least one other film that he produced, and James Gunn as well, working with him. I think he did some music or something for some of his stuff. You know, what was it like to, you know, how did this sort of, these relationships sort of build out of Troma for you? I mean, have they been good friends and, you know, good professional help for you in that way? I don't mean professional help in that
right.
context.
It's definitely established this bond of weirdness and some brilliance and some eccentricity, I guess, from, you know, everybody that I worked with that summer. And there's no one on that film that I don't, that I'm not really excited to run into and catch up with when I get the chance. And I continue to work with James on some music things, and it's kind of like, sometimes I compare it to, like, you know, some people go to college and they really affiliate with their house, or like they have some Greek affiliation that they continue to be a part of throughout their lives. And so Troma's kind of like that for me, I think.
So people can catch up. I mean, obviously we're talking about a film that's over 15 years old now. You've been doing a lot of different things since then. What's some of the latest things you're working on, and how can people find out more about it?
Recently I did a spot on Law & Order SVU. The episode's called Bombshell with Rose McGowan. That was a lot of fun. And I did something for The Good Wife. Right now, this particular week, I'm working on an indie film called It Came from Trafalgar, which has a lot of B-movie characters and personalities and a lot of fun rockabilly music. And I've got a lot of music on iTunes, and you can find out all about that at janejensen.net.
Hey, Mike, you know, I just had a chance to talk to Jane Jensen, as you heard there. Well, she wrote me like a few weeks later and wanted to talk some more about Romeo and Juliet. So here's the follow-up, part two with Jane Jensen.
Well, we talked last time, and then you wanted to sort of restate a few things.
Well, I started thinking about trauma. You know, it's been a while. And what's really fun and exciting, which has just come to my attention, is there's going to be a trauma, Romeo and Juliet reunion. And it's coming up June 28th in Los Angeles at the New Beverly Theater. And I'm going to be there. Will Keenan will be there. Lloyd will be there. James and Sean Gunn. And Stevie Blackheart and Valentine Neely. Sandy Brockwell. People keep jumping on board as the word gets around. So we might have the entire crew there for the reunion. So it just got me thinking a lot more about the film and the making of the film and some of the interesting aspects of it. And we were talking about Will, and the thing that really stands out is Will was one of the last cast members to come on board, because I think finding the perfect Romeo was the hardest part for casting. He had to be handsome and romantic, but he also had to be really tough and funny and able to pull off the madcap nature of a trauma role while still seeming like this lovelorn teenager on screen. And you know, most of the film was cast and there was no Romeo, and it was kind of a nervous vibe that was going around. And then Will showed up for a casting close to the very end. And I remember after he left, after his audition, everyone in the office was just like, that's the guy, he's the one. And there was this big communal sigh of relief about that. And it was, you know, really not long before we started shooting. So that was just something that I remembered, that search for Will. And, of course, working with him was a lot of fun. It was our trauma summer. We spent a lot of long hours, but we didn't really want to be anywhere else. I think Will had just finished up at NYU. I think he kind of went from the doors of NYU to the doors of trauma. And my other option that summer was waiting tables. So we were pretty committed 24/7 to trauma. It was a great summer. And working with Will was a blast, and I got to work with him briefly on Operation Midnight Climax, which I still haven't seen, but I hear is a very entertaining film.
Which is funny, because I put money in it.
You put money into Operation Midnight Climax?
Yeah.
You were an investor in that film?
Yeah.
Well, then, wait, did we possibly meet? Because I did go to I went to an editing suite when some of the editing was being done, but I never saw the finished product.
It was out on DVD. I think it's out of print now, but there was only one time that I was ever anywhere near New York, because I'm from Michigan. I'm from Detroit. And I went to the screening at, I think it was then called the Brooklyn Film Festival, and it was at the Brooklyn Art Museum. So I saw a different cut of the film that became that changed after Will and Gotti worked on it, and then it was put out on DVD. I actually liked the festival cut better, but that's just me. So,
well, it's going to have to make the rounds again, because it would be nice to see it on a big screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, Will was a lot of fun. He's kind of like a cross between Buster Keaton and Valentino. He's got a really classic vibe to what he does on and off screen. Yeah, Will is great. It's going to be great to see him again in Los Angeles.
That was the thing also, when you wrote back, you said you wanted to talk about those times working with Will, and then obviously what you just talked about, but also working with James Gunn post Romeo as well. Do you have any good memories of working with him on various things after?
Well, James is always a lot of fun to work with. He's got this knack for bringing out the best in people, whether you're working with him or you're just having coffee or chatting on the phone. And I don't know how he does it, but I always feel like when I'm with James, I'm smarter and I'm funnier, and I may quite possibly be more attractive when I'm with James. So I should really try to spend more time with him. But he is wonderful, and he has used my music in quite a few of his projects. I know he used a song of mine for his film Slither, and he put a song from my band, The Dolls, in Super, and I was really pleased about that. They were really great placements, and the vibe of the film and the music went together very well. So it's always great to work with James, and he is just a ball of energy and charisma that doesn't stop, and it's really infectious. So, yeah, this reunion is going to be really fun. For me, it's been a really long time since I've gotten together with the whole Troma team.
You know, what's interesting is talking to you today is that when I talked to you a few weeks ago, I posted something on the Projection Booth's Facebook page that I had just talked to you and posted. I think I posted the Romeo and Juliet trailer. And someone posted up that it's like, oh, well, I'm amazed you talked to her because people have said that you don't have fond memories of this. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to maybe squash that rumor if that was the case.
Right. Well, I probably have one memory that's not fond. And everyone, I assume that that was pretty common knowledge, but it's not, I can go into that, but I definitely have stepped back from Troma a bit. When they were doing some re-releases of the film and DVD, you know, I was pregnant, and then I had a baby, and then I had another baby on the way, so mainly that's what I was doing. It was really hard to pull my focus from doing that to, I wasn't making films at all for, you know, a couple years. I was still doing some music, but so that's why I wasn't involved with some of the re-releases and the promotions of the DVDs. You know, I was just, I was with my little guys, so that's kind of what I wanted to focus on. I really didn't want to do anything else. They are so young. And the one unfond memory that I think I always get asked about is the scene with the popcorn and the little maggots or the mealyworms, and how I didn't anticipate that I would have such a adverse reaction, but instead of just being scared or freaked out, I actually had a complete panic attack and passed out and became unconscious. And it was kind of a treacherous day. I woke up on the bathroom floor with the makeup lady, like picking these bugs out of my underpants and my little nightie that I was wearing, and it was definitely a memory that I will never forget. But it does not, obviously, doesn't color my whole experience with Troma.
Well, that's good to hear that, because, like I said, it just sounds like you wouldn't, well, my thought is, if you didn't have fond memories of it, then you probably wouldn't want to talk about it. And number two, you wouldn't be excited about this reunion. So.
Oh, yeah. No, it was the time, I guess I'd say, that I've taken away from Troma has really been mom time. And that's been the reason.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. It was great talking to Lloyd Kaufman, Will Keenan, and Jane Jensen. If you haven't had the chance, check out the episode on The Toxic Avenger for more on Lloyd, the founding of Troma, and that cult classic. For more with Will Keenan, definitely check out our episode on The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, where Will talks about his early days and what he's doing today and kind of the world of independent film. So, Rob, where do you see Romeo and Juliet kind of fitting into this overall canon of Troma films? I mean, you're much more of, I don't know if you would feel comfortable being labeled the Troma expert, but you know a whole lot more about Troma than I do, I'll tell you that.
Well, probably the Troma expert here on the Projection Booth. I don't know about out in the real world. But as I talked about on the Toxic Avenger is sort of that point where things pivot off, where from up to that point, they hadn't done horror. They had released horror films, but hadn't made anything Lloyd Kaufman, Michael Herz like that. They'd been doing like sexy comedies. So The Toxic Avenger is sort of that pivot point where it goes in the direction there it is now. I would say that Romeo and Juliet is sort of the start of the darker films in Lloyd's canon. He gets a little more cynical, a little more angry. And then by the time you get to stuff that he's doing today, it's just like full out surreal satire, really just kind of like watching George Carlin in a way, where in Carlin's early years up into the, you know, into the 70s and that, he was, you know, really kind of easygoing guy. And then as he gets further and further towards the end of his career, when he, you know, right before he dies, he's just like, you know, thundering from the pulpit, like taking his shoes off and banging them, you know. I mean, he's he's really just angry and looks back on like, you know, 70 years of his life and goes, man, nothing has changed and you're all still stupid. And I think Lloyd at times kind of feels like that. And as we kind of talked about it on the Toxic Avenger episode, where here's a guy who came into independent film in the 70s when there was so much promise, and he's sort of watched consolidation happen. He's watched other companies that he was around and other people that he was around like slowly disappear, and have seen the opportunities for independent film sort of dwindle. So I think that that also plays into the psychology of the later films. I think here is sort of an interesting point, because in 1996, you know, this is pre-DVD, this is pre-internet downloading, this is, you know, VHS is still king, theatrical was still viable, because Romeo and Juliet did get a theatrical run. So, you know, things are still good. But as things go on, it does get a little, it gets a little darker. But you can start to see a little bit of that in this. And you hear that a little bit with our conversation with Lloyd, where he does talk about that.
Now, I'm curious, had Lloyd done other filmmakers as characters before this point? Because I know in Terra Firma, you know, that we'll talk about in a few months, he's playing a director in that. And then in this one, he's spotlighting these two filmmakers. And, you know, it's kind of clever. He gets to do that and also throw in every single Troma poster that I think you could possibly want all throughout the background and everything, which was kind of nice to see. I was very glad to see the Little Surf Nazis Must Die poster as well, even in kind of the strangest places, like, you know, nice houses, and they have these Troma posters in the hallway. But had he done that before? Was this his first kind of directly portraying or having people portray filmmakers in some of his films?
I believe it would be, yeah. Okay. I think it's the first time that you see cross promotion in that way, as you were saying, with the posters for other movies. And then also taking elements of being a film company and putting them in his own movie. So it does become, as you said, more prominent later with Terra Firma, where that does show up. As a matter of fact, in Terra Firma, it's so blatant, it's actually funny.
Right, yeah. I mean, I know that Lloyd is kind of, you know, very cognizant of promotions and very much into promoting. So I was glad to see him doing that a little bit in this one. So I was curious, yeah, if that continues on in his later films. So, I mean, it was nice even seeing, you know, Kabuki Man and the Toxic Avenger kind of show up in this as other Troma properties.
You are correct, sir. Well, I think we'd really be remiss on this episode if we didn't talk about some of our favorite Shakespeare films, since we have this opportunity with Romeo and Juliet to talk about, you know, straight-ahead adaptations, crazy versions of Shakespeare movies. So why don't we see if we can get the drummer to give us some? What do you think?
Yeah, let's get that funky drummer in here for a little bit.
All right. Give it to us, drummer.
All right, so there have been, I was amazed at this, you know, because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to screw up when I went back and, you know, we did a top five Shakespeare adaptations. I wanted to make sure I didn't forget anything, so I was looking at IMDb for credits of William Shakespeare, which is great. My God, there have been hundreds of Shakespeare adaptations, and it's weird that I don't know what it was about 1955, but before that, there weren't a whole lot of adaptations. I mean, a few a year kind of thing. But starting in 1955, ever since then, I mean, there were some that had a few less. There were some that had a few more. But from my calculations, my very rough back of the envelope kind of calculations to sound like a businessman, there were about 11 Shakespeare adaptations a year ever since 1955. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. And, you know, it really, I think who probably kicked the door open was someone like Olivier. And then when you get into the modern era, someone like Kenneth Branagh, and I'll talk about both of them, actually.
Yeah, I'd say if you're going to list out the people that have done right by Shakespeare the most, those two guys, and I would add Orson Welles to that list as well. But strangely enough, none of my picks have anything to do with those guys. So I'm not nearly the Shakespeare aficionado that you are, Rob, but I will go ahead and give you my top five Shakespeare films. Number five, Forbidden Planet. So we've got The Tempest happening in that, and, you know, very young Leslie Nielsen, who is very funny in this movie, even though he's not supposed to be. Just kidding. No, it's actually a very good film. Love the use of color in it, and I really, you know, it's one of those classics that whenever it's on TV, I'll watch it. Number four, I was kind of cheating a little bit, went with a TV episode instead of a movie, and that was Atomic Shakespeare episode of Moonlighting. So any time that I can plug Curtis Armstrong, I'm going to, and that episode still makes me laugh, especially the In Case of Shrew Break Glass. So number three is Ron by Akira Kurosawa, his adaptation of King Lear. I've never actually seen Lear performed in any other language than Japanese, and I really enjoy this. Number two, hopefully we'll be doing an episode on this one of these days. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, kind of a take on Hamlet, but kind of behind the scenes, and you've got just a whole lot of stuff happening, talking about what is death, what is life, what kind of, you know, just all these great issues going on in this. And the movie version, amazing performances by Tim Roth and Gary Oldman, and even Richard Dreyfuss, who had been doing a lot of crappy movies like Moon Over Peridor right about that time. And number one, going back to my boy Akira Kurosawa, what? I'm talking about Throne of Blood, his take on Macbeth. Absolutely love that film. I just saw it again recently down at the DFT, and it never fails to satisfy.
I have to say, Throne of Blood, good choice. Actually, Macbeth is actually my favorite Shakespeare.
We read Romeo and Juliet in high school. You had mentioned reading that there, and we had also read Macbeth in that, and I got to play Macbeth during the read-through, so I was very happy, and I'll never forget the whole "Is this a dagger I see before me" speech, because I got to read that in class. I was like, this is some real heavy shit, man.
Serious. Like I said, yeah. Plus there's a whole Scottish tie-in, and my mom being from Scotland, so I love Macbeth.
There you go.
So my top five, a little more traditional. When it comes to Shakespeare, I think every time they've put out a Shakespeare film, at least in the 90s, like when I was in high school and then up to the early 2000s, I think I saw all of them, you know. I don't even want to talk about Baz Luhrmann, the Romeo and Juliet thing that he did with Claire Danes and Leo DiCaprio.
That I made it about 10 minutes into that thing.
Oh, it's horrible. I thought, that's just one of the worst adaptations I've ever seen. I'm not a big Baz Luhrmann fan, and if you want to send me hate mail, go ahead.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I am a fan. I mean, I like Moulin Rouge, but I love Strictly Ballroom. But yeah, even that one I couldn't handle.
So my top five, number five, Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet from 1996, 4.5 hours. I saw this in the theater in 70mm. It was a challenge. You took the whole day off to go see it. This is the first time that someone had done the complete text, because usually when they do Shakespeare, usually in any version, they cut it back a little bit because it has a tendency to be long. And Branagh was like, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to do it in 70mm. And he has a great cast in it. It's beautiful. I saw it at the Maynard Theater in Royal Oak. It's, like I said, 4.5 hours, and they give you a 20-minute intermission. So it was like a 5-hour day to go see a movie. Number four, right under that, another version of Hamlet, Laurence Olivier from 1948. I agree with you. It's Olivier, Brana, and Orson Welles. Those three guys really sort of took Shakespeare from this, I guess maybe this high academic plane to some extent, and put it in the cinema, at least in the sound era, and then have been able to get people to think about it in different ways and push it forward. Number three, actually, I have two Othellos. Welles's Othello from 1952, and then Kenneth Branagh again showing up. He didn't direct this one, but it was Lawrence Fishburne as Othello and Kenneth Branagh as Iago. This one's interesting to watch, especially if you watch the Welles one, because Welles does it in blackface. So, you know, most of the time when they did Othello, it was usually a white actor in blackface, kind of like when they used to do Romeo and Juliet back in the day. It was a man playing the woman's character. But it's so good to see the 1995 version with Lawrence Fishburne, and, you know, Kenneth Branagh just plays an excellent Iago. He's just a total rotter, just an awful, you know, character who you can't help but want to hang out with. He's sort of like we've talked about before, sort of the forerunner of with that character sort of being the forerunner of a lot of sort of like evil horror characters, you know, like maybe Coffin Joe or maybe Freddy Krueger or something like that, where I'm evil and watch me do my evil deeds.
Yeah, and he's completely unrepentant in that too. I mean, there is no redemption for Iago at all. He is just loves being evil.
Yeah, totally. Number two, I'm going to do the same thing again with two Richards. Richard III from 1995, and then Looking for Richard, which is interesting. It's a documentary that Al Pacino did on trying to stage Richard III and talks to people about Shakespeare and actors and people on the street. And then Richard III from 1995 is an amazing performance from Ian McKellen. This was the pre-Lord of the Rings Ian McKellen. The people, you know, obviously know him as Gandalf. If you only met Ian McKellen through Gandalf, go back and watch Richard III. He's just amazing in it. And as a matter of fact, coming up, don't we have a tie-in to this little film there, sir?
Yes, we do. We interviewed the director of Richard III, Richard Loncrane, and we'll be talking to him in a few weeks about his sophomore film, which was The Haunting of Julia, a.k.a. Full Circle.
Sounds good. And then number one on my list of top five Shakespeare films, and this is one, much like you were talking about, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, you want to do an episode on. I want to do an episode on Titus from 1999. Julie Taymor directed this. She's best known as the director mostly from Broadway. She did The Lion King, and I think she just did the Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
She's known for these really amazing adaptations of film and other ideas to the stage. She's done a few features, and Titus, I believe, was her first one. And she takes Titus Andronicus, which is considered by some people to be a lesser-known sort of failed tragedy that Shakespeare wrote. It's about the about Titus Andronicus, the Caesar in Rome, and he goes off to, originally in 70 AD, fought and liberated for the Romans Palestine and Israel and all that area, and then comes back. And what it's about is the film starts with him coming back to Rome and talking about the victorious Romans and how they fought and all of this. And he brings this Goth queen and her sons, and then also Aaron the Moor. Now, Aaron the Moor, played by Harry Lennox, amazing. I mean, just the acting in this is amazing. You have Anthony Hopkins as Titus Andronicus. You have Jessica Lange, and you have Alan Cumming in there as well.
Oh, nice.
Scottish actor. And Harry Lennox. I can't say enough about Harry Lennox. He shows up here and there. You probably know him by face, but him as Aaron the Moor is really interesting. And Titus, he is sort of the forerunner. When they've done histories on Titus, they say that sort of he's the forerunner of Iago in Othello, a lot of the really hard heavies that are in Shakespeare, and it's probably the first play in Western language, you know, in the Western canon, to really go into racism. And this is obviously, you know, 500 years ago. So this is in the 1500s. Since Aaron the Moor was, you know, he's Arab, he's black, and he's talking about in the play from time to time how he's been put under because of his race and because of all of these things. It's really interesting to consider that Shakespeare was writing this in the 1500s. And it's very, a lot of those ideas are very contemporary. So it's definitely worth checking out.
Harry Lennox, I was just looking him up just to see what else he's been in. I know him from the Matrix movies, which is kind of unfortunate. But he's going to be in Man of Steel next year. And then, speaking of Shakespeare, he's going to be in one called Macbeth, which is the Caribbean Macbeth. And he's playing Macduff in that. And that should be out, hopefully, I believe it's going to be either later this year or early 2013, it looks like. So we've got another possible Macbeth tie-in here with Mr. Lennox.
Yeah, and Titus, in terms of the design, is interesting. It's sort of like everywhere and nowhere at the same time. It's modern. It's set, you know, it's got this 50s design at times. It has a real Art Deco touch. It has a lot of the sort of fascist Italy look, and then ancient Rome. So it's sort of all over the place in terms of the design, but it really works because for me with Titus is that design really sort of brings out the universal themes and ideas that are within the play that I think Taymor is trying to get at when it comes to the ideas of revenge.
Oh yeah, well, Taymor is just a master of visual styles. I mean, I've seen The Lion King on the stage, and it's gorgeous, and the way that she uses the costumes and the puppets and everything. And then one of her smaller movies was one called Fool's Fire with Michael J. Anderson, who's most notably known as the man from another place in Twin Peaks. And that thing is just absolutely gorgeous as well. So I'd be very curious to see the Spider-Man Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, because I imagine that even her lesser works are amazing.
Sounds good. So Shakespeare, lots of great films out there to see, obviously, beyond our two lists, which are, I guess I'm the more traditional one on this. And, you know, I mean, just because it has a certain language or a certain idea doesn't mean that those themes aren't universal. And I think that that's the reason why the ideas have held up over 500 years now when it comes to the stuff that he brought across in those plays.
Well, if that really is Shakespeare, because we didn't talk about Anonymous, you know, the film from last year where it was the other guy who, you know, apparently wrote all the Shakespeare stuff and then was discredited and had his name removed from all this and all the credit was given to William Shakespeare. But personally, from what I've heard from the arguments, it sounded like a lot of bunk, but whatever.
Wasn't that from the filmmaker who told us that, like, there was going to be a giant tidal wave that was going to eat up New York City?
Hey, I like those Roland Emmerich films, you know? Not that one, but I enjoyed Stargate quite a bit.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Tell me about it, eh?
What's that?
What happened? I want to know everything you saw and heard. Everything.
Monica. Come on now, come along.
Take go of me, Annabeth Ranieri. She's my wife.
Excuse me.
Monica, speak to me. What happened?
Please, you're tiring her.
Monica. Oh. Dear, who did it? Who?
Through it over and over again. I can't get it out of my head, but I can't manage to pin it down either.
finished. He isn't even Italian, and you're making him risk his life. Somebody's already tried to kill him once.
Julia.
And what makes you so sure they won't try again? You're blackmailing him. Look out behind!
That was a preview from next week's show, Dario Argento's The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which I promise I liked a lot more than Romeo and Juliet. Join us as we discuss the first feature from the man many call the Italian Hitchcock. I want to thank this week's guests for joining us, Lloyd Kaufman, Will Keenan, and Jane Jensen, twice. And you can learn more about their work and all our episodes on the website, projection-booth.com.
That's right. Make sure to stop by the Projection Booth website and give us your feedback. Also, swing by iTunes. You can leave us a review, leave us some stars there. You can also get the podcast through Stitcher if you have that as well. Lots of great ways to do that as well. And also, I guess maybe we should put a plug in here, Mike. We still need your input. We need you to call us about Blade Runner.
Exactly. Yeah, that show has actually been scheduled finally. It's coming up in September. September is going to be a crazy month when it comes for Projection Booth podcast. I don't know what we've done to ourselves somehow, but we're doing like bonus episodes all over the place. We're going to be covering QWERTY. We're going to be covering Diptropia. We're going to be covering just Star Trek II, all this kind of stuff. And we're going to be covering Blade Runner just prior to the big Philip K. Dick fan festival kind of thing convention out in California. So we need to get your take on Blade Runner. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Which version do you like, if you like it? And just, you know, leave us your thoughts. Send us a voicemail. The number is 734-666-0800. Can't get to a phone? Hey, why don't you record an MP3 and shoot it on over to us? You can shoot that over to the guys at projection-booth.com. And, or you know what? As They Might Be Giants used to always say, it's free when you call from work.
That's right. We're having major sex.